Welcome to HeCast, the official podcast of He Changed It. As always, my name is Mike Chisholm. As always, I am excited to be here. I'm excited to have these conversations that we have with so many very cool people, telling the stories that they have, the things that they have learned, so we can maybe look at those stories and apply them to what we're going through, how life is. First off, thank you to everybody who has already downloaded the He Changed It app, who has shared it. Thank you so much for that. We are growing and growing and growing every week. Very cool, considering we're still in our infancy. I feel like a broken record saying this, but at the end of the day, we're always grateful for that stuff. We really are. Today is kind of a different podcast. It's a different episode of HeCast. In fact, it's probably going to be sort of an offshoot, maybe a different theme of moving forward of a type of show that we're going to have. I've got actually, see, here's the deal. I'm not the first Mike Chisholm. I was named after my father. And, you know, we're going to do this series here on HeCast called Conversations with My Father, because I think that everybody's got a story. And I have talked about my dad on a few of these podcasts, and I've alluded to him, and I've alluded to the fact that he has been on a journey. And that journey actually happened in his kind of his late 50s, early 60s. And now my dad's pushing 70 and is a completely different man. So I'm the son, I'm the middle child, and I look at my dad and I think he's a completely different man than he was, even 10 years ago. And these types of things leave clues. I'm fascinated to talk to him about some of these things. So, and do it on camera, because I think, first and foremost, I think it's rude to talk about somebody the way that I've talked about my dad a little bit without giving him the opportunity to be introduced to that audience. And second off, I think that there's a lot of ways that can be helped. I think there's a lot of guys out there who have issues with their dad. And whether those are resolved or unresolved, I think that that's what the purpose of these conversations with my dad are. So without further ado, the OG, the original Mike Chisholm, Mike Chisholm Sr. Hi, Dad.
Hi, son. How are you today?
I'm good, man. Thank you so much for you've never done anything like this.
No. This is very new to me.
You're not a technical guy.
Well, depends on the technical.
Okay. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. You're a handy guy. Like, you're a guy who, when Candy and I got something going on in the house, my first call is always to you. You have a you have technical knowledge when it comes to being handy and things like that.
I'm hands-on.
Okay. When it comes to computers, the internet, all of that stuff, like, you don't even have an email address.
Nope.
You don't even have, you're almost 70 years old, where as we broadcast this, it's 2021. You have slipped through the cracks. You're the guy who has slipped through the cracks and gotten to the place that you are right now and are living just fine with very almost no internet presence at but almost no internet in your life at all.
Very, very little. You've taught us to do some things with our little iPads, and we like to connect with the family and through that and the communications of that. But really, we don't utilize the computer the way that probably 95% of the population does, and a portion of that population try to emulate me in ways. There are some of us who find the computer to be not conducive to calmness.
I love how you call it the computer.
Well, and the computer system.
Is it a privacy thing?
There's a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I don't like the idea of people watching.
Right.
Not that I'm doing anything that they shouldn't see.
Sure.
But it's my business.
I feel you. Growing up, you were the guy, like, I mean, I don't know how this happens, but I think sometimes as we grow up, we look at the father figures in our lives, no matter what generation we're from, and we initially just rebel. When they make a decision that they're going to do something, we as the younger person make the decision to just go the other way. So you were always that guy. I remember when the debit card came out when I was like 11, 12 years old. And I'm like, oh, this is great. I can go to any store and it'll come right out of my bank account. Yada, yada, yada. You didn't get a debit card until they forced you to.
Yeah.
You still like writing the checks and doing all that stuff. Yep. And you will begrudgingly, when you are forced to kind of move forward, you will do it. Yeah. But you have to be forced to.
Well, I mean, the society changing, you've got to do some changing.
Sure.
You don't have to change as much as society wants you to do, though.
Right.
And because society is a bandwagon that a whole bunch of people jump on, but they don't necessarily need to go anywhere on it.
I gotcha.
And I find that a lot of people waste a lot of time on the computer.
So let me ask you this. Is part of it a fear of change? Like, you know how told that,
I'm uncomfortable with change.
Are you?
Yeah, unless it's my idea.
Okay.
And, you know, when change comes into the world, I'll accept it for what it is, but that doesn't mean I have to embrace it. And that doesn't mean I get to deny it either.
Sure.
You know, but no, change... I have a description for myself and several of my friends, people that I gravitate towards are very similar minded, in that I call us terminally independent.
Terminally independent,
yes.
Okay.
And that means sometimes it's not good for us to be as independent as we want to be. And that really is something that I find fits me, and it fits the biggest majority of people that I'm friends with and close to that I choose.
Yeah, you have friends who are like off the grid.
Well, pretty near. I kind of enjoy the rough and ready, the diamonds in the rough, as yep. opposed to the ones who are all polished.
Yeah.
Simply because I find them to be more genuine.
I gotcha.
And
take me or leave me.
Yeah, there's that. Plus, when they go to be helpful and to be giving,
yeah,
they give everything.
Okay, I gotcha.
And, you know, the genuineness that I find in people like that, grab a hold of me, and I try to give that back. And I think you know that.
Oh, well, absolutely, I do, without a doubt. I want to ask you some questions. Now, we figured out a way where Mom can put on HeCast. You've heard some of these episodes before,
oh, yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, first off, have you ever heard of me refer to you in any of the episodes?
Yeah.
Okay.
In a good way.
Yeah, okay.
And in a real way.
I haven't gone offside in anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, but okay. I'm going to go back through them now.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. One of the things that I have talked about then, if that is the case, I want to talk a little bit about anger today. And I think that I think you and I are going to do this. I hope we do this quite a bit. This is one of those things where I'm, you know, I hate to bring up things like mortality and all that, but at the end of the day, you know, that it's part of it. And the idea that you and I could maybe have some conversations, because we've had a journey in our dynamic, a tremendous journey. And you've been on a tremendous journey. And I just, the idea that I could have this conversation that could be given to my granddaughter later on in life, and she can go back and think about how you and I and our dynamic and our history and things, and to have that documented. So I'm doing this selfishly, okay? No, I'm not. I'm doing it because, yes, I am. But I also am doing it because I think it's a fascinating... I think there's a lot of guys out there who have dynamics with their father. And
I do too. And they have... It's really difficult to find somewhere where you can get explanations that make sense,
yes,
to somebody who is a little bit rough and ready.
Right.
Because they have a tendency not to have patience with it. And when they find out that they're guilty of something, they don't hold guilt well.
Right.
So it is really something that all of us need more education on.
Yeah.
Something that they really don't touch on emotional well-being in school enough, or, you know, as people are growing up and being educated. That really isn't a big part of it. It should come from home, and that's understandable, but there are many, many different varieties of home nowadays.
Well, and I think about that too. Like, I've been told, like, you're almost 70 years old. You'll be 70 years old in June of 2021. And so you grew up... late 50s, early 60s kind of a thing as your formative years. I'm Gen X. Okay, so born late 70s, childhood in the 80s. There have been articles written. I've been told, I've had conversations with people that my generation is really the first generation to actually have a childhood.
Oh, yeah.
In the modern age.
And to be able to enjoy it.
And yeah. And at the end of the day, I have enjoyed my childhood. In fact, I'm still enjoying it. I'm a big kid. Like, that's what I am. I'm literally a large child.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
Okay. And I mean, I want to talk about my childhood. My childhood, I loved my childhood. I loved you growing up very, very much. We had a lot of very amazing bonding experiences and things. And so I'm fortunate to be able to say that. Not everybody I know can say that. But that being said, there was a lot of anger in our household.
Yes.
There's a lot of anger in our household. You know, you're not going to understand this reference right now, but there's a show called F is for Family. It's an animated show on Netflix. Bill Burr, the comedian, it's his show. And he basically plays his father in the show. And I get many little ripples of, whoa, goosebumps sometimes when I see how that father, you know, it takes place in the 70s, you know, the reaction to things. Yeah. And some of the yelling and all these sorts of things that are a part of Bill's childhood as well. It was like kind of a shared thing. And yeah. Now I get to have conversations with you on a podcast. He made a cartoon about it, whatever. But at the end of the day, like, I look back at the childhood that I have had and still live, and it is vastly different. You never had a childhood. You're working like a man in your early to mid teens, right?
Yeah.
You saw some shit growing up.
Oh yeah.
And like you said, didn't grow up in a time that taught you how to emotionally deal with some of that shit.
Everything was covered up. Everything, what happened at home stayed at home. You didn't talk to anybody. You didn't bring your problems to anybody else outside the home, because it was, it's still a small town mentality,
right?
And in a lot of places in Canada in the 50s and 60s, that where the neighbors didn't have to know everything. And I mean, that's part of my independence too. That's where it comes from, is to be responsible for yourself. Really big deal. I grew up after the war, and I was born in 1951, and. There was a whole different feeling in the world. Everybody was relieved and growing. Things were starting to pick up. But it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that really the middle class showed real progress.
Right.
And it really made a difference. I could tell the difference between when my stepbrothers and half sister and brother, when they grew up, they were into that already, and I was growing up, and right. I saw the difference in their upbringing compared to mine. And
what were some of those differences?
Well, because I had a stepfather who really, when he divorced, he left five boys or four boys with his ex-wife, and then stepped into our home with my mom and four of us, four children. And he didn't necessarily bring love and everything for everybody in the house.
Mm.
And it's understandable. He mm-hmm. took on a whole load, and some of the people that he now became responsible for weren't comfortable, and he didn't make an effort to make them comfortable.
Okay, so that's the stepfather. Yeah. And there's some behaviors there that we can maybe dive into, but yeah. the let's go back to the father before the stepfather shows up. My grandpa Dave, I met him once.
Yeah.
Before he passed. And really, I didn't know that he wanted anything to do with us necessarily. But you was also, there was a bit of a shielding as well, to make sure that we were okay.
Oh yeah.
A lot of drinking.
Well, he was a binge drinker.
Yeah.
Different than the normal alcoholic in that he maybe wouldn't drink for 6 weeks or 2 months or even 3 months, but then he'd disappear for a week or 4 days or whatever. And his employment was unbalanced because of that. But he was a high quality person in everything that he did. And he would get hired back anywhere. He was a class A carpenter, the highest level. You could be a master builder if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he could almost anywhere walk into a job because they knew his work ethic when he was working.
Yeah.
The quality that he produced and the quantity.
Did you get your work ethic from him?
Probably, but I can remember when I was 16, I was working in a foundry. Mm-hmm. And
By this time, you're kind of out on your own.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And it was tough, hot, dirty, ugly work.
Yeah.
But everybody in the foundry made good money.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked hard. And that was the philosophy of the people working there. And they, you know, they bitched and complained about it after it was finished.
Sure.
And I remember making up my mind at that time that, well, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm not getting any more education right now, it looks like. I have to do this kind of work, so I better do it right so that I can continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't a gadabout or a party guy.
Say that again. You weren't a what?
Gadabout.
What's a gadabout?
Well, that's a guy who's so busy he's got no time to think.
Okay. You weren't a gadabout. You weren't a party guy.
No.
Okay.
And I wanted to have peace and calmness in my life, but I didn't know how to achieve it.
Did you even know that? Like, could you, if you talked to 16-year-old Mike Chisholm Sr. at that point and you asked him what he wanted, would he say, I just want peace and calmness in my life?
I didn't know it.
Okay.
I didn't know it because I didn't know it was achievable.
Right.
I didn't come from a house where there's peace and calmness.
Right.
There was fear all the time. And fear.
Was that your predominant feeling in your childhood, fear?
Yeah. I got home from school in grade six and, gee, I hope he's not home.
And that's dad or stepdad?
Stepdad.
That's stepdad. And you went from the frying pan into the fire in some ways.
In some ways.
From a male leadership perspective that's in your life, you really, okay.
Yeah, it was something that I never wanted to happen to my kids. Like, I carried that with me my whole life, that I wanted them to have security and comfort. And I tried as hard as I could to give that,
mm-hmm.
but I know that the comfort wasn't always there, and a lot of it was my fault. And that was because of my defensive personality and my inability to perceive things from a point of view very easily.
Right.
And that was the independence again.
So this fierce independence, if I'm hearing you right, it's two things. It's number one, well, I had to fucking get out of the house and get out on my own anyway, because this was not a place for me. Education was gone. I needed to go and so you needed to kind of become independent. You had to do that. But it was also a mentality of independence where you're like, I wasn't allowed to be independent. And so I'm going to be as independent as I want to be. Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. Well, you were expected to be a good thinker and a good behavior.
Otherwise you know.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean you knew the ways.
Oh, okay.
But there wasn't the guidance in there that should have been there to make it worthwhile, to show you the rewards of it. Because the rewards of were not there when you were that good person. Or
you just got by without an incident.
That's right. And you never knew what was going to be an incident.
So the goalpost kept moving.
Oh, yeah. There was no goalpost. You couldn't score.
Okay.
You couldn't win. And I tried really hard to not have that kind of relationship with my children and with my wife, but I didn't know how.
Right.
And so a lot of times, as a young father and a newly married person, I didn't feel successful in my life, but I had forgiving people around me who allowed for my deficiencies and made it so that I could slip through,
yeah,
slip through the cracks. And I didn't like it. I didn't like myself for it, but that was the way that it worked. And I didn't have enough wherewithal in knowledge and understanding of psychology and the other things involved to be able to direct myself away from it. Eventually I did.
Right.
But life experience is a hard teacher. And that's what happened to me. I got to the point where I was going to lose my wife and I was going to lose my family. And the way scales were much easier to read then. What is the value here? What is the important things? I don't like change.
Right.
But I had to change.
So the phenomenal part about that is you were in your late 50s when you came to that place where you were going to lose your wife and your family.
Yeah.
You got through middle age. You got through adulthood. You got through raising kids before that choice was ever thrown upon you. And I think that we both know the reason why. And her name is Bonnie Chisholm. It's my mother. It's your wife. I talk about low-flying angels that I've encountered in my life. I mean, my mom is probably the most forgiving, empathetic, loving person ever. And she would say that to us, by the way, growing up. I mean, I don't know if I'm sure you know this, but, any time that we didn't want to set dad off again, we had this amazing, loving father. But when that amazing, loving father clicked over and was set off, napalm, man. And I mean, I'm not talking physical violence, but verbal, onslaught, loud, dramatic, forceful, I mean, yeah, crazy. So we never wanted to set you off, but even on times where you would be set off, mom, all the way right up to before she kind of called time out and put you to that choice you talked about. Oh, you know what, your dad, he's just really tired. He works so hard, or he's sick. You know, it got to the point where she would say he's sick. And really, that was when you're in your 40s and 50s. And that was actually the accurate part. You had some mental switches that were kicked over when you were a kid. And you didn't even know that. And you didn't know how to deal with it. And learned it. Ironically, the guy who can't learn the internet or won't learn the internet, that kind of a thing. Ironically, in your 60s, went through this radical transformation. Mm-hmm. And showed, okay, I guess you can teach an older dog new tricks.
Oh, no question. No question. But an old dog's got to want to learn new tricks.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. And I had tunnel vision for a long, long time and didn't want to see what was right in front of me. You know, I could look this way and I could look this way, but not this way. And it was just trying to slip by. And
to then, literally get from one moment to the next sometimes
yeah, to have a good morning and get off to work and then to come home and have supper with the family and not have a disruption. And then I'd go out and do some more work.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody has a work ethic like you. I alluded to it earlier. Like your work ethic was unparalleled.
I'd hide in my work.
Right.
I'd go and I'd do some hard work and that would burn up the bad stuff and the energy that could have been bad, and it would help me, and I didn't cause any problems.
Right. Because you were being productive.
Yeah.
I remember one summer in between high school and college, I went to work with you at the company that you worked for, which you were kind of a mid-level manager, I guess you'd have to, you were kind of like the conduit between the site and the office. You were kind of that guy.
Yeah.
Ran the warehouse and did some other things.
I'd sweep the floor and clean the washroom and...
Well, you had no ego. You'd do anything. If something needed to get done, you'd just get it done.
That's...
Whatever it was.
And I had a very wide spectrum of duties there.
I'll never forget the first time I showed up. It's like 6 a.m. or whatever. I show up at the yard. And like immediately, I didn't drive with you. I drove down there separate, but we got there at the same time. And you walked in and immediately there was like a dozen plates spinning and you were like off to the races. You were like this fireball. And I was, holy shit, like watching it. You worked at a very, very, very high pace.
Well, I was, the position I had there was one that I basically developed myself there by, they hired somebody for a job they didn't know that they needed.
Gotcha.
And I filled the gap that was there that they didn't recognize. And they were a small company, just newly growing and expanding. And when something needed doing, I did it.
Right.
It didn't matter.
You were the guy putting your fingers in the dam where all the holes were and all that.
And stepping up. And it was one of the best things in the world that happened to me because I created my own environment to a large degree there. That wasn't consciously, but it needed to be done.
Yeah.
I just did it. And it was funny, after a few years of working there, people thought I was a partner in the company.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly how you,
I never dissuaded them.
That's exactly how you worked at that place. You worked at that place like you owned it.
Well, like you
took care of it, like you owned it.
It was a big part of me.
Yeah. And not in a sense of I'm the boss, in a sense of I am that dedicated to this place. Like what we're doing is so important.
You got
to
do it right.
That you got to. Yeah. And, you know, it's not just a work ethic, but it's also a quality and a care of work that you did there. And I can see burning up all this energy, you know, but sometimes like whatever it was that would set you off when we were kids, like this is one of those things where it didn't occur to me when I went until about grade six, maybe actually grade four in Mrs. Daly's class. I remember there was one thing that happened and I said something in front of a group of kids and the teacher. And I said something, and I forget what it was. But it was something that suddenly I had this light bulb moment that not everybody in everybody's house yells. I had this moment where I said, oh, yeah, you know, like when this blah, 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 blah happens, and I can actually go into it, but it doesn't matter what it is. I just this scenario where I'm like, oh, yeah, and like this, right? And people looked at me like, what? Like, oh, you know, when you set your dad off, dad comes home and he's angry and all that, and he sets off and he flies off the handle and yells and screams and whatever, and you got to run for the hills or get out of the house. And they were looking at me like, no, man, that's not our experience. And I realized that not every household was like that.
Yeah.
You know? And that was a big moment for me. I believe you had a similar moment. And I'm gonna ask you about it. I think that as we come into parenthood or leadership, whatever that looks like, I think that there are times where we're cognizant, and I don't know this is everybody, but I've asked a lot of fathers about this, mm-hmm. where it's like, okay, is there something that was in your childhood that you are going to make sure doesn't happen as you become a father? And absolutely, yes. I think all of us think of something that's like, no, that's not going to happen. Not on my watch, right? It's not going to happen. And I think that there are blind spots. For me, it was alcohol. And this is where my question to you is, I grew up also in a house where there was not one drop of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And when I would go to friends' houses and see alcohol in the display case or see it in the refrigerator, in the beer fridge, in the garage, or mm-hmm. in the actual fridge, I would be like, oh, what is that? Like, I had no idea even what alcohol was. You made a choice. I don't know if how long before I was born or if it was before my sister was born or whatever. You made a choice that alcohol was not going to be in your house.
It wasn't going to be in my life.
Right.
It wasn't going to be.
Yeah, because you didn't hang out with people that were really into it either.
I didn't fit there. Like when I say partier, I'm not a partier.
Yeah.
I don't fit into that group of people who can get looser and looser and looser and always have fun.
Right.
Because I've got too serious a vein in me and something will offend me or I will offend somebody else and I'll react poorly. And at one time, my reacting poorly was dangerous. And when I say dangerous, it was volatile and not necessarily physically dangerous, but it was certainly something to fear.
Yes.
And
well, we feared your volatility. I feared that if you got volatile like that with the wrong person, oh, hello, here we go. There's going to be a rumble now. I worried about that when I was in high school.
I cut that out really quickly when I became a teenager because I didn't have a stop button.
Right.
And the stop button is too hard to reach, too difficult, and I didn't have a stop button. So I learned that I can't get into scuffles.
Right.
Because it's not a scuffle for me. And that's just the way I saw it. But I have reason for that. I learned that. And my older brother learned it because he was an older, bigger brother.
Yeah.
And he liked to push on me and push my buttons. And that was his favorite thing.
Right.
Well, after a while, you get tired of being his plaything and you start responding. And after a while, he learned that he couldn't do that with me because he better be ready for the consequences.
Right.
Well, that was my training.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, it's such a fine line because, you know, wanting to teach our kids to be able to stand up to bullies, to stand up for yourself, to have self-respect, to fight back when you're being oppressed, those are good things.
Except when it is fighting. Then it becomes something different.
Right.
Because when you have two children who are not in their teens yet, but are seriously dislike each other at the moment and really don't have a lot of stop gaps built into them,
right,
you can have real difficult situations come up. We were very lucky in that we didn't have anything where, well, I can tell you how it was. I was very slim and slight. He was heavier and much bigger, much taller.
So there's a physical, there's a massive physical disparity.
A huge physical thing. And he could use that, man. He could use that big time.
Sure.
Just smother me down.
Sure.
But he learned that smothering me down wasn't a good idea because it's like holding a bandsaw. You don't grab a hold of a bandsaw and hold it down.
Right.
And or a cat.
Yes.
Well, I was the cat.
I gotcha.
So it was uncomfortable for him to hold me down after a while. And the same sort of thing for other situations when he'd very smart and highly intelligent person, and he could twist me up because I was younger.
Sure, of course. Yeah, yeah.
I haven't got the experience and the rest of it.
No.
And he knew how to push the buttons psychologically to make me feel very unvalued. So he didn't just do it physically, he did it mentally as well.
You know, we talk about ego. Ego is such a big thing in personal development. And many times I've heard the idea about ego being like a defense mechanism and things like that. As you're telling me the story about this, is that the birth of, you know, and I wouldn't have called you an egoic, like you weren't a braggart in any way, shape or form growing up. Not even close. In fact, you were the opposite. But at the same time, I would definitely define behavior as egoic, especially when the anger would show up. Is that a defense mechanism that was built during times like that?
It was cultivated there, yeah. Okay. It was cultivated there. But it was cultivated there, but it was also cultivated in the daily living around the house.
Right.
I don't remember my dad being a violent man, except when alcohol was involved.
Are you talking about biological dad? Or when you say biological, dad, are you thinking biological? Okay, yeah, yeah.
And years later, I worked with people who worked with him at the time when I was growing up and didn't, you know, the separation and that happened when I was about five. Mm. And so I really didn't know the man. I knew the father and the guy around the house somewhat, but I didn't really have a relationship with him that I could carry over into teenage years or adulthood.
Right.
Because it was still just, I was a child.
Right.
One of my most vivid memories of my dad is him letting me use an empty safety razor to shave in the bathroom while he was shaving, you know, and doing the thing.
Imitating him.
Yeah, and yeah. I was up, he had built a stool for us to be able to look in the mirror. And
I used to do that with you.
Yeah.
I think it's a rite of passage almost.
It's a, that well, the little guys always want to shave.
Sure, of course.
And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Really, really nice thing to remember. And I have two or three things like that. But then I have some things that are not, you know, they shouldn't be discussed. You know, they're not comfortable. They're not good.
And that's sub 5 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's.
And it had to do with personalities and relationships of the adults involved and alcohol. And he didn't drink. He didn't get married till late in life, and he didn't drink and do all that kind of stuff. And that happened after he married my mother and the children came along and that kind of stuff. And he got into that. And I think it was a defensive mechanism on his part. He's trying to feel better about himself. And the effect it had on me was that I didn't know who this guy was.
Right. So yeah. Later on in life, you worked at a place where people who did know.
Yeah. They told me that they knew him when he was drinking.
Yeah.
In the environment where he was drinking. And he would have two or three beers and he would become the tough guy.
Okay.
Well, he wasn't a tough guy. He was my size and shape. And he wasn't the tough guy, but he,
the bravado showed up.
He thought that
liquid courage. Yeah.
Yeah. And they told me he'd sometimes look around for the biggest guy in the room and call him out. Well, you know.
And then he'd get his ass kicked?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And other stuff. Like some of my characteristics come from him that I remember.
Yes.
And then other things I know that I learned later on in life. And then it seemed like after I got to be a teenager and got on my own, my independence really reared its head then. And it was difficult to tell me anything.
Yeah.
And I still, when I need correction of any kind,
yeah,
it hurts. I can't take correction well. And I recognize that in myself now, and I've worked on it, and I've given away the authority of that to really hurt me anymore.
Yeah.
But the feelings are still there.
Right.
And I recognize what they are when they happen. And if somebody says, oh, you did this, and it's really, that isn't the way we do it, or, you know, we're going to have to change that now because of this. And those things are failures in my mind. That's the way that my mind clicks over, and I should have done it the way that they wanted. But
when you say failures, you mean like big time, like alarm bells are going off, like this is not a good thing. Like,
well, that's the way I feel.
You've since learned how to work around that. But
it took a long time, and that was one of the things I liked about the job that I had for many years for that company that I worked for.
Yes,
because I got to choose what I was doing, and I felt confident about what I was doing and what needed to be done, and I did it. And I slowly built up a job there that allowed me to be who I'm best at.
And you essentially didn't fail because you were doing what needed to be done at all times. You knew how to do it. You were in the perfect box. Yeah. You knew exactly how to negotiate your way through it.
And I trusted the people there.
I want to go back to the so. You and Mom at some point, like, did you say to Mom, we're not going to have a drop of alcohol in this house?
Well, yeah, but it was in our early 20s before we moved to British Columbia from Ontario.
Sure, yeah.
We were newly married.
And my older sister is around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Eve is there, and we're growing up, and we were establishing a home and doing the things that young marriage do. And
yeah.
And we eventually bought a house and did the things that most people try to do.
Sure.
But I still didn't drink. And I've listened to people at work talking about this and talking about that, and there was always a party.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm not seeing it the way that other people do. Mm-hmm. So I said, and I told Bonnie, I said, I want to try something different to see if we can broaden out the people in our lives and learn different things and that. And we tried the, I don't know, the party scene if you want.
Sure. And you let loose?
Well, not really, but I changed who I was chumming with.
Yep.
Well, if you chum with the guys who only like to have fun, you better be one of them.
Okay.
And I wasn't. And Mom isn't. She loves a group of people and sure. happiness and laughter and jokes and all the things. But she grew up in a household where there was no alcohol.
Right.
Whereas I grew up in a household where alcohol was poison.
Right.
But it was always there.
Yes.
So my learning was very, very different from hers.
Okay.
And then when we started involved with a group like that, and then the opportunity to move out west came up, and I looked at what I had for alcohol and stuff in the house, and this was in October we moved out here of that year. And
late 60s?
No, yeah. We came in 74.
Oh, 74. Okay, yeah.
And I looked at it and I had a bottle of whiskey that was half gone and a box of beer. There was still 12 of the 24 left. And this was in October and I'd bought it at Christmas time.
Okay.
Because most of the people that we knew weren't drinkers. And I was trying to get educated on this group of people and find out about them, but we'd always do it somewhere else or, you know, go to the dance and that kind of thing and find out what they're like. That's how we were trying to find out about them.
Sure.
And I looked at that and I said, man, here we are, you know, 9 months later and I've still got this stuff hanging around the house. Do I really need that?
Okay.
And then I said, no, I don't. So I gave it away before we moved out west. And when we got here, I said, I'm just not going to buy any alcohol. I don't like to drink. I didn't like the feeling of it.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to drink.
Would any of the tendencies of your genetic disposition, you know, you think about Grandpa Dave and all some of the things, when you did drink, was that stuff there? Like, were you like, okay, I also see that there's a potential for massive pitfall here? Did you ever have any experiences like that?
Well, not an opportunity to really lose control, but the fear of it was there.
Okay.
I found that I wasn't as nice as I wanted to be when I had alcohol in my system.
Right.
And I wasn't comfortable with that.
Right.
And I didn't get the feeling of utopia that some people get, or, you know, the happy
euphoria, like that. Oh yeah.
Yeah,
like
everything's
that.
Great.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
I didn't get that.
You were chasing no dragons.
No.
Gotcha.
And I'd seen lots of bad stuff with alcohol. So I said, no, that I don't need that.
It's funny though. Like, I mean, interesting, just the growing up in that, or growing up lacking that. And I'm grateful for it. Like, I'm very grateful for it.
You got to choose.
Well, yeah. And it was a different choice than any of my peers. It was a completely different situation. And I appreciated that, that growing up. It's interesting that that's a decision that you make. It's almost like, you know, when we become parents, you know, we get in the rowboat and there are some holes in the rowboat and we can fix certain ones. But there are certain ones that are, you know, either behind us or whatever. And the snapping and the anger and all that was the one that didn't get fixed. It was the one that didn't get addressed until much later in life. And I mean, we've got so many other things that we can cover. And I hope we do have more conversations and talk about this because I think there's a lot of meat on that bone. But I want to, you know, in the interest of time, I want to talk a little bit about, you alluded to it earlier. In your late 50s, you were basically brought to a crossroads, mm-hmm. a choice. Mm-hmm. where you were going to lose a significant portion of your family, in the sense of your wife is the biggest, obviously the biggest one. She pieces out, separates yourself by, you know, 3,000 miles, semi-permanently, if not permanently. And at that point, you were faced with the idea that the reckoning with your anger either was going to happen, if you had even a chance of getting your family back, or it was going to just continue on the way it was.
It did happen. That did happen, and it had tremendous effect on me. But I had made up my mind previous to that, by several years, that I had to find out who I was and why I was the way I am. Right. And I searched and searched and searched, and I had really, really no luck with.
How did you search? You search your thoughts? Were you reading? Were you talking to people? What were you doing to search?
I was doing those things. I was asking questions where I thought I could get answers that were reasonable and that. And I was looking for medical or educated opportunity to learn from people and to find out just how they handled these things. Mm-hmm. But there isn't a lot of places where guys go to talk about this stuff.
Right.
And
my wife's building an entire app because of that.
I know. And you just don't know how happy it's made me. Because of my experiences, for about 5 years, I joined a men's group where we met once a week. And the rules there were that everybody had to be honest. You had to talk and make real stuff. And you'd get called out if you
were bullshitting.
If you were trying to pull something over, put something over their eyes. Because we were there to learn from each other. And
so this wasn't an angry men's group. It was just it was a men's group that you were a part of that could be any number of reasons that people would be a participant in that group.
It was the guy who ran it was a counselor who had difficulties with anger. And part of his learning process, he was a school teacher for many years, and then he quit school and went back and got more education and became a counselor. Mm-hmm. And he was so easy to take directness from.
Okay.
You could tell that his heart was only trying to give you good stuff. He'd tell you that you're wrong, but he didn't tell it like you
didn't flip those switches that were critical to you. That your hair trigger.
He was
on.
Telling you because he wanted to be good to you.
Okay.
And he wanted you not to have the situation that is created when you get angry.
So when you were at that group at first, were you broken at that point, or did you become broken? Because you've talked to many people about how, and I think I've even said this on the podcast, you have to have this almost rock bottom moment of realization where you're being real with yourself and you're at that place. Did you go to that group at that rock bottom place, or did that rock bottom place happen while you had already been introduced to
that
group?
I knew that I was creating a rock bottom place. And I had to change. I knew I had to change. Yeah. And I didn't know how to. And I was trying to find out how to. That was my motivation. Mm-hmm. And I went through many, many different programs that were 3 weeks of this and, you know, where you'd go two evenings or whatever. And you get a little touch of something and you get a little touch of something else. And then I probably about 4 years or 5 years into my search, I came across this group that's all they did. They're just the men's group. That's no other name.
No titles, men's group. Enough said.
It was an opportunity for men to come and talk, say their situation, what their day was like, and maybe get some feedback from some other guys there about how they handled that same sort of a day.
Yeah.
And there was nobody there earning any money you put a few bucks in if you had some of the cookies or something once in a while. And there was coffee there. And it was just guys sitting in a circle or around the room chatting with each other and saying, you know, you said this and it really made me think of this that happened to me. and what I did in that situation. And a whole bunch of that was going on. And you'd hear people who handled things that you mishandled, mm-hmm. who handled them so well, you'd say, oh, man, it's so simple. But it's not.
Right, of course not.
Because you got to have your ducks in a row before you can go in a line.
But because everybody has a different vantage point, the strengths of some are the weaknesses of others and vice versa.
Yeah.
And so there was impact that would be had just by guys sharing of their stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of the things I saw there, the tremendous differences in people over time mm-hmm. because of this stuff, because it started to affect me and all other portions of my life. And it was after my heart attack, after I had to quit work.
I want to do an episode on that entirely.
The illness settled in and I had to, it really was a huge, huge blow to me to have to quit work. And there was all kinds of emotional upheaval going on with me. And that didn't help my anger.
No.
And when my anger reared itself, it would be so severe that it was scary to me.
You'd scare yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it was blind rage. And there's a huge difference between rage and anger, too. Rage is beyond it.
Okay.
And much, much beyond it. And I found that my anger was literally a second away. Whereas lots of people, it takes some time to build anger.
Yes.
And mine wasn't like that. And that was when I go back and look at and think about the things that happened, and I discussed it with counselors and with other people afterwards, I was programmed. I was programmed to be angry.
Right.
And I didn't have any defenses built into it because I was only programmed to be angry.
Right.
And that's the only solution to things that I knew. And it was something that worked.
How did it work?
The whatever I was angry at would go away, not necessarily be fixed or repaired or improved upon, but it would be disappeared.
Almost like the child with the tantrum works,
yep.
except in an adult, a very adult and very different.
Very, very, very similar.
Okay.
I can remember having two tantrums when I was a kid and afterwards, many years afterwards, I go back and I think about it, and I was taking advantage of people with my poor behavior. And I really felt bad about it once I realized what I was doing. But I was operating on their weaknesses mm-hmm. by creating an activity that they didn't know how to handle, and I was taking advantage of them. And I remember twice doing that, and I don't know why I didn't do that more often, but I didn't. But after marriage, and I did that with my brother a couple of times, but it didn't work so much with him because he just wanted to needle me or torture me a little bit more to see how far it would go.
Right.
And, that's when you have to learn everything yourself, or it feels like you have to, it's tough.
I feel like we are just scratching the surface. And the reason I feel that way is because I know that's what we're just doing. We're just scratching the surface. But I would like to, I think you've already given some very interesting food for some very interesting thought for some people who watch or listen to this. There are definitely guys out there who either have it in their life where somebody in their life is angry, or they themselves are, and they have that inkling that the way that they act doesn't go on in everybody's house, in all the houses that are out there. What would you say? Give some little words of wisdom as to what you'd say. And as we do more of these, we'll talk and get deeper into it. I know you brought your binder and all your stuff. I knew we wouldn't get into that stuff today, but
that's okay.
I mean, this is a journey. You've been on a real bona fide journey where you have completely transformed yourself. I remember talking to my younger brother who lives, on the East Coast. He lives out in Montreal. And I mean, he hadn't seen you in years. And I mean, obviously there was a fissure that was built between the two of you. And I'd say, no, Dad's different. And he'd be like, no, I don't believe it. And, it took a while to get that. And thankfully you you can say, and he can say, that you both lived to get to that point where he's seen you on the other side of this, just like I have, just like my sister has, like mom has. There is another side. You don't have to be in that existence where you're at the brink of losing everything. You don't have to live there. And I guess let's finish up a little bit by talking about some solutions for people.
Well, that's really easy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why is it really easy?
Because first thing you have to do is take responsibility.
Okay.
And once you take responsibility for who you are and the situations you cause, you can have any excuse you want in the world, but it doesn't stand up because who's responsible?
Right.
Who makes the choice? And I had one of those epiphany moments where the light bulb just comes on. And I was in one of the men's group meetings, and somebody said, well, it was a choice. And that clicked in my head. Everybody makes choices all the time. Every day of their life, they make choices. And a choice is either go or don't go. Say or don't say. Move or don't move.
So you become present in that moment where you recognize the fact that you have a choice when before you might have been.
I don't have to be angry.
Okay. And that never occurred to you for decades.
That's right.
It didn't occur to you that you didn't have to be angry.
No.
It's that simple.
It was that simple in its start.
Okay.
But then it got complex. and the complexity was simply because, okay, I know what I want to do. Now, how do I do it?
Okay.
And in my 65th year, I was learning how. And it was really, really interesting. And there's no age requirement. There's nothing. All there is common sense and a will to do it and a willingness to do the work required and do the learning required. And it almost sounds too easy, but it is hard because everything is a decision. And every time you look at anything or consider anything, you have to make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And life becomes very serious until it becomes natural.
Right.
And when it becomes natural,
lot of people... Not thinking about it anymore.
A lot of people have it already.
Yeah.
They have it. They don't know what I'm talking about because what they do. And it took a long time for me to be able to honestly look my wife in the eye and say, I know who I am and I know what I did and I don't want to be that person anymore. And she believed me. Yeah. I got the best wife in town.
Yeah, you do. I'm not biased because she's my mom. You're right. You have the best wife in town. You do. Goddamn, I was going to ask you if it was difficult for you to talk about this stuff today, and I was expecting a no, but now I got you at an emotional moment.
No, so. that is a good moment. I have the ability to recognize my wife for who she is and give her the credit that she deserves. I've always felt that way about her, and I have never, ever talked my wife down, ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. No, and you never have. I mean, you've been angrier than a fucking hornet, but you don't, I've never heard you say a cross word about mom to somebody else. You know, even in your blind rages where everything is everybody else's fault, that was something that I never, and I would hear like your coworkers talking about, oh, the wife, oh, this, oh, that. You were never that guy, ever. I'm really grateful. And I do think this was a start. And there's all sorts of places that we can go with this. I'm really grateful that you were like the idea growing up of Mike Chisholm Sr. being vulnerable, was a joke. Like that just, no, dad would never, I mean, we were afraid to ask you personal questions because you were so, you know, you were so not that guy. And now you being an open book where me in my 40s can actually ask you about your childhood, can actually ask you about some of these things, and you'll actually fucking tell me the stuff that you haven't blocked out. I mean, there's all sorts of, again, like I say, all sorts of meat on that bone. I want to thank you. This podcast is going to drop right around Father's Day. I'm really grateful that you, I don't even know. Is this out of your comfort zone now? Or has this been hard for you? Has this been talking with me about this with cameras on us and all that shit?
No, like, it isn't. It isn't, because it's who I am and what I feel, and it's what's important. To me, the more I can celebrate my willingness to change, and the more I can show it to anybody and everybody, but people who matter most, they're the ones who need to see it the most, because they feel me. And that's who I want to communicate to. And when I think about the suffering that I created and the suffering I felt with being just unaware that I don't have to do that, it's such a waste of time and energy and effort that nobody should go through. Mm-hmm. So whoever hears about it is, I hope that there's some benefit in it. If there's not, I hope that they find an opportunity to share that or to point somebody else to it, because I went for a long, long time searching, trying to find solutions, things that would turn the switch and get me going in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I am so glad to be going in the right direction. What I feel is the right direction, and the fact that it was my choice and my learning and that to get me to be better. And that's the value of it. And if somebody else can get to feeling better and being better because I said a few words, that doesn't hurt.
Wow. I'm grateful. We got to finish up now. I told you it was going to go by fast. Mm-hmm. I think we're probably even over what we normally do. So thank you for your time. Thank you very much for opening up the way that you have. And thank you for changing. Like, I'll say this publicly, like, you and I have a friendship. We would have had a relationship, whether it was strained or there were boundaries that were like, I mean, during the dark times, we had to put up some pretty big boundaries. And I'm happy to say that we've torn down those boundaries since then. And I'm very grateful for that. And we don't just have a relationship. We got a friendship now. And thank you for taking your personal story and being willing to talk to people about this, Dad.
Well, I hope that it does some good.
Yeah, well, it will.
I always feel better when I'm honest with my family and the people that I care about the most. And it is a wonderful thing to be able to do.
Weight off the shoulders.
Yeah. And, you know, it's okay if I'm not perfect, and it's okay if you're not perfect. Mm. And that,
thank God,
life is so it. Much easier when I can recognize that.
Yeah.
And I was a stickler for everything. When I thought I was too much of a stickler for things the way they had to be done, and that, and I'm finding that isn't necessary.
It's okay not to be perfect.
Yeah.
It's a perfect place to end it. For our next one, they go by really, really quick. This was a neat one for me. They're all neat ones, for their own way, but this one here is obviously, I think you can see why it's so special. Thank you for taking time out of your day to, either listen to us or watch us. This has been Conversations with My Father, an episode of HeCast, the official podcast of He Changed It. Thank you for watching. Go change something.